All right, welcome. My name is Jay Stalnacker. I'm with the XPRIZE Foundation, and I'll be the moderator for today's panel. I'm going to introduce myself and allow our speakers to introduce themselves here in a second, but I want to talk about why we're here. And we're here because wildfire is a problem that has reached into places and in countries and areas around the world that now either have never seen these devastating, destructive wildfires, or these fires are getting worse. And so our panelists and myself, we're going to discuss how technology can help with the detection, the early detection, the timely detection of wildfires, and also how we can automate possibly response. On top of that, what we want to talk about is what does that all mean for you and I, for all of us? So I think it's important that we want to allow some time for questions also. So we'll look forward to hearing from the audience, and we do appreciate everyone being here. So again, my name is Jay Stalnacker. I work for the XPRIZE Foundation. I'm the Wildfire Competition Tech Lead. XPRIZE is a foundation, a nonprofit that incentivizes technology through competition. And you may have heard of our first competition, the Ansari Prize, which was incentivizing private space flight. And we all know what happened with that, and that was almost 30 years ago. Today we have over $300 million in prizes. We currently have six different competitions going, everything from mapping the rainforest to reducing our carbon footprint. Our focus is really on audacious challenges around environment, health, and in this case, wildfire. So without further ado, I'm just going to allow our speakers a minute or two to introduce themselves.
Good afternoon. Rebecca Harnett. I'm a senior advisor for data and technology with the U.S. Fire Administration, which is a component of the Federal Emergency Management Agency.
That was nice and quick. I like it. So, hi, everybody. My name is Ryan Lenklaus. I'm the Director of National Government and Public Safety at ESRI. For those who know ESRI, we're a mapping company that combines the science of geography with maps to visualize that data in new ways and look for patterns. In my role related to wildfire, I lead our disaster response program. So we are kind of the operational arm receiving requests for assistance from people that are faced by wildfires and other disasters around the world. And so my perspective today will be a bit of that data, a bit of the science with that, and some of the forward-leaning things that we see as opportunities collectively as a group. So this is my first time at South by Southwest. So for those that have been here before, I'm learning from you as we go, and this has been fun to kind of get to experience even a short period of time. So thanks for coming to join us and being a part of the panel today.
Set Kamaya. Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Christina Snyder-Ashtari. I'm Mihila Kauna and Makamo, and I'm a member of the Dry Creek Rancheria Band of Pomo Indians in Sonoma County, California. I also serve as the Governor's Tribal Affairs Secretary in California, where I oversee all of our tribal affairs, Native policy, and Indigenous policy as well. I had to evacuate from a pretty big wildfire in Sonoma back in 2017, and so have some on-the-ground experience of what's happened in our communities as a result. So excited to join this conversation.
Thank you all. Privilege to be up here and talking with these folks today. And I'm going to go ahead and start with Rebecca and talk a little bit about what is the current landscape. How about Texas? How about a million plus acres on fire a couple weeks ago, and if not even still currently. So let's start there. So Rebecca, you know, what are some of the main factors of data, you know, that we're tracking that's trying to tell us what's happening? You know, why are these fires getting worse? What are you seeing?
It's a great question, Jay, to get us kicked off. So I think we're all very aware of the threat that wildfire poses in terms of actual wildfire in the wild land, as well as wildfire as it bleeds into our urban areas known as wildland-urban interface, and then sometimes prompting the appropriate term is urban conflagration. So structure to structure, ember movement from a structure to another structure producing a pretty large-scale fire. So there's a lot of factors going into that, obviously. The benefit now is that we have more data and empirical evidence to help us understand the wildfire hazard exposure risk in our community, as well as understand a wildfire as it's unfolding in real time. We certainly saw that here in Texas recently with the fires in the Panhandle. I think at last count, it's well over 1 million acres of damage. In some ways, you could say, fortunately, there's not many people up there, which means the structure damage is, I think, at around a little over 100. But there's other consequences to wildfire, and that's the impact on economy. So that is an area that relies heavily on the cattle industry, right? And the cattle were directly impacted because of the impacts and reduction of their grazing lands, as well as the time of year that it is when they are rearing young cattle. So just a lot of cascading consequences that we better understand now. But the other factor in all of this is looking at us getting smarter, actually applying that data to inform how we develop in our communities. Where are we building new structures, whether they're commercial structures or residential structures? Are we adopting the right building codes and what we call wildland urban interface or WUI codes in communities that are fire prone? A third of our population across the US lives in fire prone areas. That's the reality. How do we get smarter about how we develop?
You know, it's a great segue for that word communities. And, you know, Christina, you know, Native Americans, according to some studies, 6 times more vulnerable to these types of incidents. So with that in mind, what have you seen for an impact? Speaking of, you know, these impacts that are kind of hidden to the normal person, let's say.
Yeah, so I can only speak to what I know, which is probably more California-focused. But in California, we've got 109 federally recognized tribes, and those tribes all have trust lands that tend to be outside of city centers and tend to be in more rural areas. As a consequence, there's fewer response mechanisms for when there are these giant wildfires, but there's also a lot of legislative and regulatory barriers for tribes to be able to mitigate, prevent large-scale wildfire. So what we've seen in California is both the impacts to air quality that we've seen a new study talking about the impacts on California indigenous people is much higher than it is on anybody else, and part of that is because of where indigenous people live. But we're also seeing impacts on things like cultural resources. For example, we've got the giant sequoias in California are actually a cultural resource for the local tribes. And a lot of what we try to do in partnership with tribes at the state is to prevent impacts to those places that are sacred, meaningful part of belief systems that predate the United States. So another piece of it is that we're seeing the consequences of wildfire run into our rivers, into our streams, impacting our salmon populations, and again, our sources of sustenance, but also a key part of native belief systems in California. On top of that, we also see that Native communities, because this is where a lot of people live, because it's either on tribal lands, adjacent to tribal lands, are having impacts to their communities and where they live. And so I saw firsthand with my tribe working in Indian child welfare how the 2017 fire that ran through our communities, which was an example of an urban, conflagration that kind of came through the mountains, came through the wildlands. A lot of our people actually had to leave the state because they could no longer afford to live in community, could no longer afford to live in a place like Sonoma County, which, if you've ever been there, is actually super expensive to buy housing in. And so you really see the impacts of these large-scale conflagrations displacing community from places that people have been since time immemorial, where their belief systems are based, where our belief systems are based, where our food sources are, where we convene and have community. And so you're seeing just large-scale disruption of lifeways in a way that I don't think people have seen for millennia.
Thank you. That's, you know, we talk continually about impacts. And, you know, Ryan, Esri is an amazing partner to the fire community, to the whole disaster and emergency response community. You know, with the destructive nature of these fires now, what are you seeing in technology from the ESRI side?
Yeah, maybe I could approach this with a bit of numbers, right? Data that's telling the story to kind of balance what we're sensing and feeling as people, right, in this space. And so I pulled some numbers for this. You know, Jay's making a point, I think, you know, how firefighters are leveraging technology. Well, there's an organization in the U.S. called NFCE, the National Interagency Fire Center. Think of them as the aggregation of data across all destructive fires that are reporting perimeters and how the firefighters are mobilizing and the assets and resources they're putting on fires and monitoring those. So oftentimes you look at news media, you see reports come out of so many acres burned and so many people. That's really where this data is coming from, which can tell us a lot if you look at that data. And so I pulled some numbers to set the context of what we're seeing in terms of quantifying fire as destructive. So on average, you can say that there are roughly 70,000 fires per year, right? That's just on average in a year. There's a bunch of those things that are burning out there. Some are the destructive, some are good fire, but 70,000 fires that they're tracking at the National Interagency Fire Center. In 2021 in the US alone, that meant more than 7 million acres were burned. That was a massive year. If you remember back in 21 with the fires that are being referenced, that year was actually twice the national average in acres burned in the U.S. Now, we just talked earlier about Texas as over 1 million acres alone just now in the early part of the season. This isn't even fire season for the U.S. picking up. So that's an example of how things are being exacerbated. Now, maybe another way to think about how it's impacting more than just firefighters in this data, you could say that when NFCE first started reporting their data and people were going to the site to look for information about fires, they had about 300 users 5 years ago. They have 22,000 firefighters and users feeding data into a system. So resourcing this from a government perspective and financing is increasing exponentially. 22,000 members reporting into a fire system, looking for data from a fire system, truly the ones boots on the ground. So it tells you that there's a manpower issue that's also going into this problem that isn't sustainable long-term as well. And I would be remiss if I didn't say, you know, even if we look beyond the U.S., this isn't just limited to us here alone. So if you think in 2023, most recently, the fires in Canada, that was over 18 and a half million hectares of fire. So that's massive. And what does that mean for us? Certainly it's burning lands across the border. We see it on the news, but it's the air quality indices that resulted in the worst air quality in the world being captured on the east coast of the United States, exacerbating issues related to asthma and health issues for communities. We see those numbers also increasing as a result of fire. So it's not just the fire burning the trees, it's not just the fire burning the property, it's fires extending that catastrophic reach into other sectors that we are starting to experience. So I would say that none of us are immune from wildfires, even if you don't live in the urban interface or in the wildland area, it's becoming an issue for all of us. And the last thing maybe I'll say about the changing nature of fire and data, what we see, Rebecca's comments were spot on in the way she started, which is that the nature of the fires we see are changing dramatically. It's not just the big fires that we saw on the panel, which is catastrophic. Please don't take what I'm saying it's not catastrophic, but it's the fires like we just saw in Maui and Lahaina. It's Boulder area where we had the conflagration event outside of Boulder, wind-driven fire that started in the wildland and moved into that space. We see this repeatedly, and there's the Lytton fire up in British Columbia was the same exact scenario. And so as people are moving to the edge looking for cheaper land and more affordable living, they're building into these fringe areas that are now more exposed. And there's other reasons we'll get into later today, but I would say that as a number to put around that to make sense of it, in 2023, there were 4,300 structures, a little more than 4,300 structures destroyed. 2,300 of those were in Maui alone. So when it takes off and we get in these situations, it is catastrophic, it is life-changing and altering for communities, for people. And I would say that as we start to look at this, you know, the average over 10 years is 3,500 structures a year. It's going to continue to climb and get worse. And so I think data tells us that we see empirically, just in the monitoring of what the situation has been and what we see today, getting worse in all aspects. That's requiring more money, more people, more resources, and affecting a lot more than it ever has before. So.
Thank you, Ryan. And actually, that raises a really important point in terms of looking at wild lands burning, meaning natural vegetation and land versus the number of structures destroyed. What that also equates to, it's not just a matter of how much is burning, it's about what is burning. Because when a structure burns, just think about how much plastics are in your home, right? Or in a commercial facility or whatever else. the burning of that material and the impact that that also has on climate change is very different than when you look at vegetation burning. And so wildfires become this cycle, right? We know that changes in our climate are putting an increased risk of fire, whether that's drought and everything else, but it's also a cycle. We're increasing the risk, especially when we have the burning of large, you know, structures and multi-structure events. So I just wanted to raise that because it's an important understanding about that. Thanks.
Yeah, and I think there's, you know, a couple words that I heard throughout all the conversation so far, and two of the presenters mentioned good fire versus, let's just say, bad fire. And I do want to highlight, you know, I was a fire manager in Boulder, Colorado for over 20 years. And I was also a fire practitioner for over 20 years. So as much as I spent time fighting fire and putting fire out, I put just as much time putting fire on the ground. Why? Well, fire is part of the natural ecosystem. It's a natural disturbance. And we, as we just said, have made fire's way much more difficult to move around us. And now in some areas, we can't even allow fires to burn. Natural lightning caused fires to burn and do the things they need to do. So remember that, you know, that natural disturbance, it's required. In every environment, whether it's a flood or a fire, those things, a beetle kill incident where we lose all these forested trees, they have to happen. Otherwise, that fuel load is going to build up and build up and build up to where we're seeing things like this. The other word, impact. And I think, you know, Christina, you know, knowing that I'm a fire practitioner and working with tribes and others putting fire on the ground for good purpose, you know, you touched on the impact now to your community. What's changing, you know, with this destructive fire message?
Sure. So it's actually been very recently that California has started acknowledging that some of its laws haven't actually meshed well with the natural ecosystems of the state, and that a lot of our biodiversity actually depends on these natural cycles of low intensity burns, sometimes lightning strikes, but also sometimes intentionally set by indigenous peoples who's managed the land since time immemorial. So a quick history lesson, because we actually look through a history lens in California in this administration, is that when the state was created, low heat, low intensity burns of prairie lands that were actually practiced for forest management to have healthy, pest-free acorn crops, to have cleared prairies so that deer could be easily hunted. All of that was outlawed because the American government, coming from a European perspective, viewed all fire as inherently dangerous. So Native people were then able to be arrested, put in jail, vilified basically for doing these practices that's actually essential for certain plants to thrive, for certain populations to do well in California. What we've seen recently is that tribes in partnership with the federal government, in partnership with private enterprise, and in partnership with the state are now re-engaging in what we call cultural burning, which is that periodic burning of different places for spiritual purposes, but also for sustenance purposes. How do we ensure that we can go out and gather acorns and make sure that they're pest-free? How can we make sure that our forests are healthy, that our sequoias are healthy, that our giant redwoods are thriving, and make sure that this forest itself has the nutrients it needs based on these chemical processes that happen with low intensity burning. So what we've done at the state in partnership with tribes is help them have the tools they need to be able to engage in this very, very old practice of cultural burning, which is a bit different from prescribed burning. And have created the legislative vehicles to be able to do so in a way that makes sense, you know, given that there's also the risk of large-scale wildfire when you introduce fire to the land generally. So we've been doing that. We've also had some conversations actually with Australia, and we may have a cross-collaborative partnership with them where tribes go to Australia to learn from the practices that are happening at places like Uluru, and they would come to California to learn about the practices that tribes are having here. But because we are talking about technology, something that's super important is thinking about and using technology and leveraging technology to map out where are the good places to be doing this, how do we make sure that we're not, you know, overdoing it in a certain area, what are the risks that we need to be thinking about as we move forward. And so again, California has been, I think, leading the way in reintroducing good fire to the land and understanding that it's a critical part of a healthy ecosystem.
Thanks, a great response. And you know, I would challenge everybody in the room, let's just do a survey. Have you been impacted by wildfire? And I'm talking just not my home's been burnt down, but some impact. So this number of hands would have been way different 5 years ago. And that's how quickly things are getting worse. And there's many causes, and we've kind of painted a dire picture a bit. So let's talk about hope and change and technology. And, you know, I think, Rebecca, let's start with you. And what technology do you think can help us? And more importantly, how can it help us, if that made sense?
It's a great question. Thank you. So a couple of considerations here in terms of technology and how we can better equip our communities as well as our local fire service, both to be able to prepare and respond to a wildfire, whether that's a fire in the wildland-urban interface or urban conflagration or even a true wildland small event. So there's a couple things. We're really looking heavily at GIS-based technology, so that's geographic information systems, similar to the technology that Ryan has been touching on a bit, and using that in a variety of different ways. One of the big areas that we need to develop a shared understanding of our wildfire risk across every single resident in every single community across the United States. Preparing ourselves, protecting ourselves from a risk perspective is a responsibility that each and every one of us have, not just a responsibility of the American Fire Service. So that's a really important starting point. But if that shared understanding of wildfire risk can be had at every single resident and every business owner, it's also shared with that local fire service so they can better respond. So from a U.S. Fire Administration perspective, we're working on building out some very initial tools that will be publicly available to help raise awareness and understand exposure to WUI hazards at a residential level. So that's one area that I think is exciting. Another area is early detection sensors. So there's been new technology that's been developed. I know we just were actually out in Hawaii on the initial deployment of these early detection sensors across the island of Maui, and I think they're putting them on some of the other islands. So, and this is very promising. If we can get detection of a fire ignition out in the wildland at the start of that ignition, and that can be suppressed immediately, it doesn't have the opportunity to spread into the WUI where it's going to have the impact on our people and also on our environment. So I think that technology is really exciting. I know XPRIZE has been engaged in some of the development of those sensors as well, and that's something we see as a lot of promise.
Yeah, you know, what we're doing is we're incentivizing that technology to grow, and we currently have $11 million as a prize purse for innovators to solve this problem. Quicker detection, autonomous response. It sounds crazy, but it is the future. And AI is part of that in making decisions that humans have a difficult time making because we don't have all the information. And technology can help us now get that information quicker. And so that's what our competition is doing, is really pushing the limits of that. Ryan, you and I have both worked, I think everybody here has worked outside of fire on numerous disasters. Fire just has to happens to be the conversation today, but you know, everything from hurricanes to floods to you name it, and man-caused disasters, worst of all. And these are now international, right? You know, we mentioned Australia, we mentioned other areas of the world, Portugal, Spain, all of them are experiencing fire seasons and fires that they've never seen. There's been fires close to the poles, you know, in the Amazon. These are areas that aren't fire friendly, and there's no good fire use there. There's just the vegetation and the animals aren't adapted to it. It doesn't belong there. So Ryan, how do these technologies converge onto all these disasters? Like, where do you see that intersection?
Well, I think it's easy, like as you're talking, my mind goes straight to like the response, like the detection and suppression of a fire. But I think we miss an opportunity not to back up for a second and maybe think about holistically about pre-fire or pre-disaster work that goes into this. I think when we go into situations and we get a phone call, you know, can you help us map the response? Like, the first thing we're typically asking is, you know, what kind of data do you have about the landscape, to the people, like the built environment? It's trying to recreate kind of an understanding of how the landscape is existing today so we can kind of model potential disruption for the future, right? And I think if you think about fire, bringing it back to fire for a second and wildland fire, the challenge I think we're seeing is that, you know, climate change, when you say that word, is a spark in and of itself. But it detracts from the ability sometimes just to have an honest conversation that things are different today than they were yesterday. I mean, whatever word you want to put on or the label you'd like to add, like downscaling global concepts like climate change to a local community so that somebody sitting in California can sit down at a neighborhood table and talk about how we mitigate or do structural defense for my home and build that. That's a really large leap for some people to do. And so I think one thing I see as opportunity across all disasters is that we have to start thinking about building a system that allows us to understand the people, the places, and the economics that exist today so we can look for vulnerabilities and equities. And that means, two, you have to go beyond just gathering data. You need to talk to people. Right? You need to be in the community, sitting there, listening to what they believe is the most important thing and where they've experienced repeated loss before from floods or fires. That can be built into these models that we see that help us then predict or anticipate better actions, whether that's adaptations that need to occur, it's new building codes, for example, as my colleague said earlier, or it's where we just need to put money and mitigate issues around these. And, you know, there are limited funds and resources for everything we do, and I think that's one place, if we're not spending our time and effort, we're going to lose the fight even when it comes to response. So I wanted to say that maybe before I get to the response phase of it. So now the fire happens. I think there's a huge potential here that we see breaking out. As I was thinking about this panel a bit, I was thinking back to Jay in your days, and you'd be the one to talk about this better than me, but you know, I think about the fire tower. Right. For me, it's been hiking in the woods. You see the fire tower. They still exist out in the West. And, you know, it's a tower. They literally would send somebody up and they would camp out in this tower on the shift and they would just watch for smoke. Think about that eyesight, right? What they were looking for is detecting that as early as they could to be able to radio that in and get somebody on scene to assess the situation. You know, the colleagues are talking about new sensors coming out to detect smoke in the air and to classify that or to look for camera sites. There's alert wildfire cameras across the West that are watching like a fire tower used to. And it's not just looking at an image, but it's starting to detect the trickle of smoke or a little bit of a heat thermal that tells us we should be paying attention now. So number one, I think it's about that idea of, you know, bringing all the cameras and the sensors together. And number three, I say in this space of sensorization is just that, the platforms that are overhead and above us. There's a tremendous amount, as my colleague, Kate, who I always like to reference in this situation, leads our imagery team. It's like, there's a lot of metal in space right now. And that metal's doing a lot of cool things. Think about all the pixels that are being captured of our planet repeatedly, both each and every day, hour by hour. Like, if we're not harnessing that in combination with the cameras and the local sensors, we're missing an opportunity to start to do early detection. That's kind of why XPRIZE is really focused on this. Like, how do we bring all of that together and get as quick of a jump as we can on the situation? So I think that problem exists in every single disaster, no matter where you go in the world. If you don't have all the data in kind of single place and ability to start to take advantage of it, you're already behind the curve. The second thing I think we have an opportunity on is around modeling with that data. So there are tremendous advances in wildfire modeling. People do this each and every day, and there are scientists that focus on this in the federal government and private sector, and their job is to look at weather conditions and fuel, moisture, and all the details that come together for a recipe to start a fire and then to predict where that fire might go. But think about now if we can combine that modeling in real time with the sensorization that we just talked about. So now we've got a system that's telling us There's an early smoke detection here, or a heat detected there. And based on current weather conditions and fuel moisture, the models tell us this is where it goes, and it classifies it as bad fire or good fire, to use the simplistic terms. We're suddenly ahead of the curve in terms of putting resources on the fire and deliberately putting the right resources into a fire situation. To me, that's the other missing component for all disasters, is taking advantage of science to model these impacts and anticipate when we should take action, or frankly, change policy to allow things to burn and move through the community and through the underbrush to clear out the future space. So those are things I see in every disaster. I think they're specific to fires we just talked, but I do think those are persistent no matter where you go around the world.
Thanks. I think I'll close the impact part of this and jump, we'll get to the technology part because it's pretty exciting, by sharing a couple personal stories. Is there any first responders in the room? Anybody related to a first responder in the room? Okay. That's one of the impacts I think we forget about. Currently, for the wildland firefighter community, our suicide rate matches or exceeds military. And when you look at how small our community of wildland firefighters is in actuality, that's pretty terrible. I've lost two friends to suicide. One, a leader in our field, a man that was the incident commander at the 9/11 site. Those impacts, you know, we don't see those every day as community members. And we sure put on a good hard shell outside of us as firemen and women and to not let that in. But I do believe that is another impact and something also that can be helped with technology. Not so much like treating or counseling. Those are steps that are absolutely needed. But getting us out of harm's way is something that can help with the PTSD and the other mental health issues that come from being exposed and constantly exposed to structure loss, community loss, life loss. So, you know, together, we bring all this together, and hopefully we can not only save the trees and the grasses and the animals, but the people, and including the communities and the firemen and women. I think, you know, next, I'm trying to get my notes opened up here, forgive me, but I think really what we need to think about next, Ryan, is what are these technologies? You know, you talked about sensors and we talked about metal in the air, in the sky. Let's talk about some of the technologies. Yep. What are the new emerging technologies?
Well, I think, yeah, maybe start above and work our way down to the ground. I think, you know, above us, there is missions being launched every day to put rockets up that carry metal to space, as we said. You know, hyperspectral imagery. So think about the advancement in satellite technology. Some of you probably work in satellites and imagery technology, a handful. You should probably come up here and talk about this better than me. But the fact that you think not long ago we were looking at black and white photos of grainy issues to where we are now, which is, you know, looking beyond just true color to multispectral, now to hyperspectral, like that gives us insights into every little element of our world. It's being things to monitor greenhouse gas emissions in the future. It's looking at, you know, biodiversity and the loss that we're experiencing and be able to monitor this and think of it taking like the heartbeat of our world in real time. Like that's where we're headed in terms of bringing it. Now, the challenge becomes that is big, big data, right? It's not just a little bit bigger than multispectral. Hyperspectral sensors are a magnitude above and beyond. And so for firefighters and for communities to be able to take advantage of that data, we have to be thinking about advancing technologies to get closer to that data. And so that's where we see, you know, cloud compute, which is mooting, you know, the geoprocessing tools in our world that map that and allow us to look at those burn models and regression models in real time as close to the data as possible, so that then we can just deliver actionable intelligence out. That's the key for firefighting, right? They don't necessarily care that the picture was captured and something over there is off. They want to know, when do I take action and where, and to help them get in front or to get out of harm's way into it. I think that is where we're headed very, very quickly. The fact is that there are so many platforms going up. If we're not thinking about how we connect them together and exploit them, we're already behind in that place. Part two of that is when we have that data available and we've got systems to allow us to connect to the aggregators and pull all that in, how do we best exploit it, right? I think this is where artificial intelligence can really start to help us, right? It's thinking back to the watchtower with a human that was watching the landscape. We need to be able to train the computers to watch the landscape and do it better than we ever could have. And certainly it's already being done in some cases, but think about doing it faster and at scale. That's part of the XPRIZE challenge, is how do we detect very small scale fires early on, classify them, model them, and then take action. And when I say take action, it's not just deliver a large, massive file to somebody over a slow bandwidth internet. It's maybe just send a simple message saying, this geographic coordinate has a fire that needs action right now, and then follow that with other information as available. Like, think differently about the problem. I think that's what we're trying to do together. Harness all that big technology. To me, those are some of the big things coming in the satellite. Maybe I'll stop there because there's a lot more we could go into.
Yeah, and I'll even rewind us. You know, Ryan went up. I'm going to go back, yeah. If that makes sense. You know, I was a smoke jumper. Do you know what that is? That is a somebody jumping out of an airplane in a parachute into a wildfire. We could do a little better than that. Think about it. Think about the last advancement in technology in wildland firefighting. 60 years ago. 60 years ago is the last time we've introduced new technology. Sure, today we have big 747 planes that can hold 5,000 gallons of retardant, and we have more helicopters and more hotshot crews, but we're still smoke jumping. And, you know, my smoke jumper brothers and sisters are probably cursed at me, but the reality is it's antiquated, and it's not effective in these new types of fires. Out in the wilderness in Idaho, yeah, works great, right? Works great, but not in Boulder, Colorado, or Hawaii, or Texas. We can't rely on ourselves even to progress technology and using in disaster management. So, Rebecca, help me. What are you doing? What is the organization doing? Because they are at the cutting edge. What you're involved in is at the cutting edge that's going to make our jobs so much safer, ultimately.
It's a very good question. And it's interesting and it's complicated, but it actually comes down to a pretty simple framework. How many of you have heard Ready, Set, Go? That's actually pretty good, and that's what we want to see, is a greater awareness of what it means to be ready and to be set and to go, and looking at how technology can help us be ready, be set, and then can help us make better decisions that are going to have reduced impacts when we do have to go, whether that is residents having to evacuate, or whether that's firefighters who have to respond, right? So I come back to the Ready, Set, Go framework for this conversation, because ready and set from a residential level needs to occur in what I call blue sky days, when there's nothing burning, right? We have to ensure that we are always ready, we are always set. Right? And that starts with understanding if we live in a fire-prone area, if we're in a season, if we're facing conditions because of droughts or otherwise that are potentially increasing our exposure. So it's an awareness that we have to keep now every single day and everywhere in the country. Wildfire risk is no longer just isolated to certain western states. It's something that we face nationwide. And sort of bringing that to the forefront is really paramount in using data and information. And then as I talked about sensors, and I think about that sensor technology deployment of these early wildfire sensors deployed out in that WUI area, that's the set. We're set. We're ready for those notices. The same thing with the space-based information, all the metal in the sky. We're set because we're already collecting this imagery, which is essentially intelligence. So if we can find out that a fire is starting, we can see through thermal imagery or whatever, we can put it out faster. So that's that go piece, right, from a suppression standpoint. If we can deploy the firefighters, and now I'll also introduce something, ground robotics, right, from a technology perspective, if we can have those pre-positioned in areas that we know may be at higher exposure so that, again, we're lessening the impact on our fire service and we're able to get that fire out faster. So I could go into a lot of the science and technology aspects, but I think that Ready, Set, Go framework is really important for us to be thinking about in this conversation.
So I love the Ready, Set, Go. I'm going to steal it in a future conversation. It's fantastic. But I do, you know, some of this you were talking, and as you said the same thing, Jay, I was thinking about the phone in your lap. Like the other thing we haven't really talked about is like persistent communications across areas that typically don't have it. And if you put firefighters and smoke jumpers out there, how do we continue to talk to them? I think one of the big grand challenges outside of what we're talking about today and is an act through the federal government trying to improve this is how do we get firefighter tracking in real time? Because again, if we're putting people in harm's way and we're not alerting them and sending all that relevant information in real time, we've missed the opportunity. And so I think I would just maybe highlight for those in the audience that are thinking about how you contribute to this problem of fire, how do we communicate effectively and make sure there's persistent communication in areas that need it most? And that's not just a problem for fire, obviously, but it's if we're ready, set, and go, we've got to be able to tell people to go, we got to reach them where they are, and we got to help those robotics find it and the firefighters to get out of the way at the same time. So just something that I think we should at least acknowledge is a challenge.
Absolutely. And if you look at, you know, the technologies that the military is using, for example, right now, I would ask myself as a fireman, why don't we have access to that? Why don't we have trackers on us that airplanes can fly over and figure out where we're at? Because we're antiquated, because we haven't taken the next step growing up as an organization. And, you know, organizations like Rebecca's, Ryan's, and are helping us do that, and you are too. So let me ask a question. Who has a Best Buy or a large grocery store chain near their house? Okay, who has a shopping mall near their house? Imagine one day you're driving to work, to the shopping mall, and the entire area is on fire. The entire area. This is what happened in Boulder, Colorado. People are standing in a Best Buy parking lot watching the world disappear in front of them. Right? So this is a whole new thing for even firefighters, is what I'm getting at. And, you know, so the technology is one thing to embrace. It's also getting the technology to the firefighters, but it's also getting the technology to the communities. So Christina, like, where are those hurdles? Like, getting these technologies, like, I would love to give the tools of detection, observation to a tribal community to be able to do safe burns. Why? What's going on there? Why are we fighting that?
That's a good question. And I think that that's one of the barriers that I think we need to address in order to deploy equitably across not just the United States, but across the globe. One of the things we see with tribal communities is there's a handful, at least in California, that have their own fire suppression agencies. So they have fire departments. They typically are cross-coordinating with the local county. But also, a lot of times, they aren't cross-coordinating because the local county doesn't want to share resources, information, and the like. We see that across jurisdictions generally, where there isn't a lot of trust, and so there's a barrier there. You know, I do think that if we can get to the point where we are cross-sharing what we learn through technology, what we learn through whatever gets developed for early detection, that'll put communities that are in rural areas and maybe don't have the resourcing that we would want to see in a better position to be able to strategically deploy suppression, strategically deploy people, strategically deploy information. A lot of times we also see that tribes are situated in places where when communications towers go out, they're the first that are hit. So we don't have easy access to information. The person living on the hill that doesn't get service is going to be the first person that doesn't know about the fire and also may not want to leave and may not know the severity of it until it's too late. So what I see... I don't quite know why the barriers are so bad. I know that there is a lot of distrust. I also know that there's a lot of distrust about how much information that tribes share with other communities. So when we talk about being able to effectively plan, we also talk about how do we input information about where our sacred sites are, where cultural resources are, where there's critical infrastructure that needs to be protected on tribal lands. And a lot of times that information isn't easy to share for tribes because both the state and federal government have a really bad track record of keeping tribal information safe or not realizing that this is actually super valuable information that should not be exploited or extracted or made publicly available, but should be protected in the way that the tribe asked for it to be protected. So I think, you know, in theory, it would be amazing if we had this great information database that everybody could access and that tribes could also equitably access, whether they're, you know, the wealthiest tribe and the most well-developed tribe in the state or the nation, or whether they're a community, you know, in the Amazon that is also just trying to get by and not have as much interference with an outside world that doesn't have the same values. So, you know, in theory, I think that would be amazing, but also there's all of these different cultural expectations and also real distrust that I think we need to overcome in order for that to be possible.
Yeah, and firsthand experience, honestly. So I was an operations chief for a Type 1 incident management team. These are the teams that go out to the big incidents and, you know, we try to help. So we're trying to hold a fire, protect a community, and we want to burn a piece of land, you know, backfire it to hold that fire. And we could not get the tribal community to give us the information we needed to protect their interests. And we ended up losing some really critical cultural historical resources on that fire because the information wasn't just available, let alone readily shared between, and I'm not blaming anybody, it's just the reality of, like you said, is there a solution? What is it? But that was pretty saddening to walk with the tribal community across that landscape post-fire and see, you know, remnants of teepee rings and other things that we could have protected easily. We could have easily protected it. And now everybody knows where it's at because there's no trees hiding it now or no vegetation hiding it. So that is a great point. And, you know, as we move on, sorry, got to get my electronic device up and running. Let's go, you know, a little bit about what's next. You know, so, you know, I want to set us up with, you know, the XPRIZE and what we're trying to do. Ryan stole my thunder. The modern day fire tower is my tagline. It's really what we're trying to do. You know, we're trying to create a system, challenge innovators like yourselves and others to find a way to autonomously detect an incipient stage wildfire. And I use some key words there, right? Autonomously and incipient stage. So as Rebecca said, as soon as possible. And also the right fire, meaning if it is a good fire with good use and it's doing good things, let's let it do its good things. If it's a bad fire, let's get it before it even becomes a blip on Ryan's map somewhere in the air, right? So with that said, you know, closing out on what's next, you know, Christina, we've talked about the struggles and the hurdles. What are some of the positives and what can we do with, you know, you touched on the communities around the world too, not just in California, not just in Texas, but in the Amazon. And these are places, again, that are not seeing, that have never seen fire for that matter. So what are you thinking about that? And what are some solutions around technology with that?
Well, I think if the XPRIZE is successful, we could deploy this type of unmanned detection and suppression technology to places around the world that might not actually be able to benefit from it or be able to afford it, and really impose equity on a world that's not built for it. I see in California as like the example that I'm going to every time, if a tribe could plug into this type of system, could have early detection, could put in their own information based on what they know about their lands of like, hey, we've planned this cultural burn, this is actually fine, so we don't actually need to send out suppression technology. Everybody go about your day, and that feeds back into a system where the tribe doesn't necessarily need to share anything sensitive, but the state knows, the locals know that this is happening or that there's something going on. You could put tribal communities, you could put indigenous populations in a space where when this happens in their homelands, in their ancestral areas, and at their sacred sites, they're just as well equipped as the city of Los Angeles, as the city of San Francisco, to be able to suppress and detect this wildfire. So I think you see, if you have successful creation, deployment, equitable deployment of this type of technology, you might see indigenous populations be able to better protect themselves from some of the harder impacts of climate change. in a way where they won't necessarily need to be inviting a lot of people in who might not share their worldviews or values, and would be better equipped to do that on their own.
You know, and we mentioned this XPRIZE thing, but, you know, what we are trying to do is create a safe space for innovation. And sometimes government, I worked for government for many years, we get in our own way. And, you know, politics gets in the way. And then next thing we know, we have another destructive wildfire. And we're talking about it again. And when you join forces together, like with a nonprofit like XPRIZE, with ESRI, with the U.S. Fire Administration, with local and state government, we all of a sudden can make change. We could use these technologies now, because our barriers aren't your barriers, and our solutions may overcome those barriers and vice versa. So I think the partnership you see up here is part of the solution also. So with that said, Ryan, you know, what are you most excited to see of technology? Stuff in the sky, the modern day fire tower, what are you looking forward to?
I'll go back and say I'm excited to see a map, right? I think, but this map's different, right? The map I'm thinking about is different, and you'll kind of chuckle because you maybe know where I'm headed with this. I mean, it's, think about navigating uncertainty in life. Like, you turn to a map. When I was a kid, sitting next to my granddad going across the country on a trip, I was navigating with the atlas, looking what's ahead, trying to anticipate where we wanted to stop for lunch, or I was going to go see the next cool thing, the world's largest ball of twine. But we need that map and that inquisitive nature around fire. I would say what we need is a real-time fire intelligence system. And it's map-based, right? It's context of geography that matters. It matters where things are located, where people are located, where they interact with fire and the elements of fire to truly help change behavior. And so I think what I'm excited about, what's next, is evolving the concept of a map into something different. And I think that's why XPRIZE, you know, the work you're doing to kind of bring teams together, it's going to take everybody that's working on the Medellin space to get new sensors up that are better, more persistent, have revisit rates that are useful, and resolutions that are the right resolution to be able to sense small fires when they start. It's trying to get those that are working in AI to look at advancements in that technology in a way that allows us to model behavior, to look for patterns, and to recognize when something is at a tipping point. And then we need a way to get it to the firefighters and residents and people that need it at the far end of that. The map has to land in somebody's hand. And so I think what I'm excited about is all that coming together, because it's going to take a lot of different people all doing their own piece of that puzzle. And, you know, I was thinking back when you mentioned earlier, Christina, about just this idea of trust. And many of you will know this person. My boss always references Richard Saul Wurman, who had this quote that said, collaboration moves at the speed of trust. And I think for this to work, it's going to take every single one of us in all facets of technology working together. It's going to take people in communities being willing to sit around that map and to look at things differently and to ask questions and to provide input. It's going to require government to listen and maybe change policy. It's going to require us as residents to maybe think differently about how we move into an area or not, or when do I buy insurance or not buy it. I mean, it's all these factors. It's not a simple problem to solve, right? That's why I think I say a real-time fire intelligence system is the future, but I think it's at a map where we can come together and start to really look for common patterns and commonalities and find a path forward. So that's what I'm excited about.
Yeah. You're killing it today. You know, that map is worth gold and more on an incident, to be honest with everyone in the room. You know, I could recount the days of using township range and section, if anybody knows what that is. And then we finally moved to lat longs. They allowed us to, because Garmin came out with the portable GPS devices. And then right before I retired, I had an iPad in my lap in my truck, and I was actually having aerial imagery sent to me almost real time on fires in the middle of the night. And it was amazing. And a little blue dot telling me where I was on that fire line. And boy, if we could just figure that out, so to get that technology in everybody's hands.
Hey,
so
we're doing it South by Southwest. Like, yeah, South by has a map, and everything you do, navigate me to the room, find where I go. Like,
I love that.
We should
that,
be able
right?
to do that for the same. Like,
yes. You know. So, what are you excited about? What do you see this in the future?
Yes, so there's a lot happening, and I think what's exciting, I certainly echo Ryan's comments with regards to the map in collaboration as those two key words that I think we all need to take with us. But what we're seeing is an interest in a commitment to solve this wicked problem of what I'll call bad fire for the purposes of today, right? We are seeing an interest in a commitment by the private sector, research and academia, NGOs, state and local government that we have never seen before. There is a coming together for us to work on better protecting our communities, right? In solving this. I see, you know, one observation I've had recently, particularly in the private sector space, but also in the research and academia space, is everyone is working to do what I call the race to get AI for the wildfire problem. The same way there was a space race, there's a wildfire for AI race, which is really cool and exciting, right? And we're innovation is happening at a rate that we've not seen it before. And I think that's exciting. What I think is sometimes challenging is, like, can residents and the American Fire Service, can we adopt and use this technology at the rate that it's becoming available to us? Because to your point, do we trust it? Can we build trust in our use of technology so that it can actually be effective in ready, set, and go, right? And I don't know the answer to that. I think we're working towards that. But at least from my experience kind of working across the country with the fire service over the last almost 20 years is that we are seeing a culture shift, I would say, obviously at the, you know, local resident level, but also in the fire service in terms of the inclination to use data and technology to help drive decision-making and educate the public that I see a lot of hope in. So, Jay.
Thank you. I do want to leave a few minutes for questions. I wanted to leave more time, and we're willing to hang out for a little bit. So, audience questions. Please, sir.
You steered away from one of the largest contributors to increasing the size of the problem, and that's our government actions. When we stopped doing controlled burns in our national forests, when we started in California to make it so expensive that no one will do dead and dying removal anymore, when we stopped doing dead and dying removal in the national forests, which are the majority of Northern California, we ended up increasing the fuel supply by such massive amounts that we had the million acre fire in Northern California. I own 3,000 acres up there, been there 50 years, and have watched this change. We've gone to conservationism instead of ecology. Even the Indians, if you look at what they did, go to an area where you had four valleys coming together, one was kept in old forest and very carefully protected, one was a recent burn that they had done within the past 4 or 5 years after the early rains, so they had meadow. And they let them burn, and they let them do that in a sequence. But they were ecologists. They weren't trying to save every tree by pouring plastic on it, and save every bird by encompassing it in plastic. They allowed nature to do its thing. And we stopped in California doing that, and there our fuel supplies are so large that almost anything, and we've also put in policies. When that million acre fire started and was reported almost immediately, and it was reported within an area that the Ukiah tankers couldn't put it out. It was decided by Forest Service, U.S. Forest Service, to let it burn to get rid of some of the understory. And we had a million acre loss.
Yeah, you know, I see your point. I've talked to many communities throughout my career. In some ways, you know, I don't see a question that you're asking as much as I see a point you're making, and it's a valuable point, and thank you for sharing, really.
Please.
Yeah. Hey, Jay.
Hi.
A finger in the back.
Well, first of all, congratulations to the panelists, a great discussion. My name is Antonio. I work for a tech Brazilian company focused on GIS. By the way, we are an ESRI partner.
Nice.
So good to be here with you. So Ryan, my question is: what would be your advice to Brazilian government to prevent wildfires that occur every year in the region of Amazon, Pantanal, Mata Atlântica, knowing that the perspective there is different, so the data is different. We don't have so much kind of data that you have here. The regions are huge to monitor. So what would be your advice to the Brazilian government?
Yeah, I guess my advice in your local knowledge of the area is the important thing you're referencing, right, to do that. Just like we've all kind of our experiences, I would say lean into that. My advice is the system that we're talking about, this real-time system to gather data about the environment, about the infrastructure, the tribal communities that live within those areas, the built environment, start to amass that data together to get the understanding that's needed to address the problem. Because there will be good fire, there will be bad fire, there's forestation, deforestation, there's all sorts of things that are going to conflict at times within that. My advice is to think about the system that brings it together and allows people to understand those complexities, and then to sit around a table on a map and have a shared conversation about the real challenges on the floor. I think that's where geography can bring people together and have a context of a common location to really, you know, have disagreements and have agreements at the end of the day, because you're going to have trade-offs in all things in life. That's my advice, is to have that conversation and lean into it, frankly. Yeah.
Hi, Earl Barg. I just want to ask about insurance companies. Can they help with risk management? Are they investing, or are they withdrawing?
Yep. Nope, you inhaled first.
No.
You know, first.
Yeah. I've worked closely with insurance companies as an incident manager. Many have already started implementing their own fire service, protecting their clients' resources. There's challenges around that, and that is the opposite of collaboration in some cases. So we have to balance their enthusiasm of protecting their investment with the collaboration needed to do that. And that's where I see insurance companies really can be a bigger part of that table talk around the map, if we will. Please, we'll go till they... she's kicking us out.
Oh, she's saying we have to stop in the
back.
We're done.
Sorry, I'll be out in the hallway if anybody wants to talk to us.
Thank you.
Thank you.